Case numbers 24-5319, 5320, 5341, Chelsea Estep v. City of Nashville, Tennessee et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Melissa Ruberge, for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Melissa Ruberge on behalf of the defendant officers. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. When officers reasonably perceive a deadly threat to themselves, their fellow officers, and a highway full of onlookers, the law grants them qualified immunity for their decision to use deadly force. And that grant of qualified immunity extends to every officer and to every shot fired when the shots come in quick succession and in a condensed 5-second time frame. Let me say that differently. Officers have at least 5 seconds to perceive the threat, act on it, perceive any new information, make a new decision, and then act on that decision.
So based on your concept, the 5 seconds, is that just a black and white, if it's 5 seconds, so long as there's a, whatever happens in that 5 seconds is okay?
What precedes the 5 seconds, Your Honor, is important. What happens within that 5 seconds is also important. And this isn't a new rule that the officers are advocating for. It's a rule that dates back to Utland and then Mullins and then 3 months ago in Najee. So Utland stated officers have a few seconds to respond.
Why would we adopt a 5-second rule? That doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, setting aside the other officers, when I watched the video and when I watched Officer Murphy, everybody else had stopped shooting. Somebody else had yelled ceasefire twice. He was on the ground. It struck me as incredibly gratuitous. So to say that they don't even state a claim with respect to him, that I find that quite astonishing.
So, Your Honor, you're uncomfortable with deciding the constitutional violation question, the court can pivot to the clearly established.
But why wouldn't we say the rule is clearly established that you can use deadly force if there's a probable cause of a threat? But I think you would concede that we have clearly established additional rule that you have to cease using deadly force once the threat has gone away. And then the question of whether the threat has or has not gone away is a question of fact in my mind. And here, I would think the complaint, taking out complaints allegations as true and looking at the video, a jury could answer that question of fact, or at least we don't even need to say a jury. At the summary judgment stage, it's plausible that the question could be answered that the threat had gone away at the time that Officer Murphy shot.
So I would direct Your Honor to the Mullins case. And that case, after kind of a scuffle with the officer said, drop your gun. And what the suspect did was throw the gun over the officer's head. He was unarmed for 2 seconds. The first shot was fired. Another 3 seconds passed and the second shot was fired. And what the court found, and the court decided it on the constitutional violation prong. And what the court found was that even at the time of the last shot, so 5 seconds, at the time of that shot, the officer would have been acting under the circumstances or under the perception that he was still armed. So it's important to put yourself in that moment. We know now, with the benefit of hindsight, that Mr. Estep wasn't armed. But what the officers knew in that moment was that Mr. Estep had been hiding his hand in his right hoodie pocket. And after 30 minutes of tense negotiations, he changed the dynamic.
But would you agree that what I said was correct on the law, that it is clearly established that officers must cease using force if the fact if the threat has dissipated?
I would agree that that is a broad general proposition of the law, but qualified immunity requires a more specific rule to be applied, and that under these.
In their pleadings, didn't they say that the threat actually had ameliorated? There was no longer a threat of imminent harm. So if that broad rule applies and these specific facts have been alleged in the complaint, which they're plausible. I didn't see anything in the video that blatantly undermined that statement. Then don't we have to accept that?
Your Honor, I think that's the wrong question. I think the question isn't, had the threat ended? It's, what would a reasonable officer perceive? And would the law tell every reasonable
officer? Isn't that...
The issue is there an imminent threat of harm for the officers? And so I hear what you're saying. Officers get an opportunity to make that assessment. It sounds to me like you're saying that there's some time element that where we just, there's almost a gimme. Like, well, if it's in, within this time, you assume that whatever, that they can't make that shift during, because it's such a short period of time. Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't say that an officer can't make the shift, but the question is, would every reasonable officer know that they have to make that shift within 5 seconds? So that, would they know that their decision time is only 4 seconds? I'll note in the time that it took.
I guess that's what I'm not following you on. It's really about the threat, isn't it?
It is about the threat, but it's also about the perception of the threat and when it ends. At the time that the officers are shooting, nobody knows which gunshot belongs to who. And so they're operating under those tense circumstances.
Do you say that it is clear from the video that the last two gunshots are attributable to Officer Murphy?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you say that they are after the ceasefire is yelled?
I, from watching the video and hitting play and pause multiple times, it appears that they seem to happen simultaneously. But if it is after, it is less than a second.
So it seems like you've raised an important question about, you know, how quickly do we expect officers to perceive in a given situation that they need to cease, to stop? I mean, even if we say it's okay in the first instance that there was a threat of bodily harm or deadly force, that it was okay to shoot, there's a point that we would expect officers to stop. Why is it not a fact question in this case, like what a reasonable officer, like in this situation, how they would be able to perceive it and what would be reasonable to ask an officer to stop? Like, for example, if there was a ceasefire yelled.
So I think Your Honor's question goes to the first prong of qualified immunity. What could be reasonable? Where are we going to draw that line? But I would encourage the court to look at the cases that were cited by the plaintiff to clearly establish the rule that they want applied here. And again, that rule is that within 5 seconds, every reasonable officer would know that they would have had to have perceived that the threat had ended. And the cases that they cite are factually distinguishable. Let's start with Baker. Baker isn't even a deadly force case. There, after a brief foot chase, the individual walked out of the bushes holding his hands up. That told the officer that he was unarmed and compliant.
So I guess I'm confused about the clearly established prong in as much as we have case law saying, you know, if a person is completely down and no longer a threat, you cannot shoot them. Would you agree that that's clearly established?
I would agree that that is clearly established so long as the officer perceived that that had happened. So that's
the question here, whether the officer had perceived that had happened. That seems like a really a fact question and maybe one that a jury eventually would have to figure out. But it doesn't seem like whether a reasonable officer would have perceived this is kind of like as a matter of law question that isn't specific to a given circumstance.
Your Honor, I actually want to put a finer point on my previous answer. It's what would every reasonable officer have perceived? So the Fourth Amendment inquiry is much more objective. And if I can take from the panel's question, it appears that the concern is with Officer Murphy's final two shots and not necessarily the other officers. And for Officer Murphy, if you look at his body cam, he is getting in position to be ready to fire. So at the time he's fired, a reasonable officer already would have made that decision based on perceiving the threat that Mr. Estep posed to the other officers. The law grants him qualified immunity in those circumstances. And so we talked about the Baker case. The next case that the plaintiffs point to is the Russo case. That is factually distinguishable. There are three different volleys of shots in that case. The first, not constitutionally problematic. An individual ran out of the apartment holding butcher knives. The officers used deadly force. Then the individual fell down the stairs, and then the officers waited 10 to 12 minutes. 10 to 12 minutes objectively is enough time to reassess. But 5 seconds is less time than it took for me to introduce myself to the court this morning.
Can I ask you just briefly, so I don't want to talk about Officer Murphy now. I want to talk about the other officers and what has to be pled in a complaint where there is uncertainty over which of the officers fired a shot. So hypothetically, it was 30 seconds later, everybody would agree it was a violation of clearly established law. And it was one of three officers, but we don't know which one. Can they file a complaint against all three officers and allow them to obtain discovery to determine which of the officers fired this gratuitous shot? Or how does it work at the pleading stage when there may be an excessive shot, but you don't necessarily know kind of in the chaotic moment which of the officers shot it?
I would say in that instance, the plaintiff does have the pleading burden of identifying which officer violated their rights.
Why? But so I had this case at summary judgment, and I agreed with the premise you're making at summary judgment because I thought they had a duty to raise a genuine issue of material fact, which means they could prove their case by a preponderance of the evidence. And if it was between two people, you couldn't prove your case by 51% because it was equally likely. But at the pleading stage, why wouldn't you say it's just plausible that any one of the three did it and then allow them to get discovery? If they can't get discovery to figure out the identity of the culprit, then perhaps at summary judgment, but at this initial stage, why shouldn't they be allowed to have discovery?
Because to unlock the doors to discovery, you have to allege that each particular officer violated your rights. So in the hypothetical that you're proposing, maybe one did, but they haven't gone through the effort of identifying that person. But we actually don't have that problem here because they've identified Officer Murphy and all of the shots happened within those 5 seconds. And no clearly established law told the officers that they had to react and stop shooting faster than that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Have your rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. David McKenzie here for Chelsea Eastep. And taking off my glasses because I'm just refreshed. Basically make my arguments for me. I find it particularly scary, some of the issues that have been raised by the appellants in their briefs. Yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. I find it particularly scary, some of the issues that were raised in the appellant's briefs, especially with regards to this 5-second rule. And Judge Davis, you brought this up just perfectly. This fit coming in my own mouth itself. What if there was a clear fatal shot that had happened within the first second of a police volley? Does that allow the police officers any carte blanche 4 seconds to do whatever it is that they wish to do from that point forward? Would we, as a society, want to justify such unfettered bloodlust and give that to governmental officials? And that is exactly what I keep hearing over and over. It was listed in their opening brief. It was listed in their motion in opposition to our motion to dismiss. And so we talk about these issues from a very...
In fairness to your friend on the other side, I think some of the argument here and the argument that maybe you want to take on is that once people perceive a deadly threat, that there's just some reaction time, right? And that you're in the motion of responding to it and that maybe there's some... reaction time to both respond and then both to disengage. And so it might not be bloodlust or something like that happening in 5 seconds. It doesn't mean that maybe we don't go on to summary judgment and figure out what happened. But I think your friend's argument is much more nuanced.
I do. I agree with Your Honor. I think that a ruling from this court, however, that would grant what they're asking for, which would be a blanket 5-second carte blanche, would send a very chilling message to the rest of law enforcement in our Sixth Circuit, because how would they then make a factual distinction in every single case that would come forward where there is an issue of unreasonable use of deadly force?
You would agree we can look at the videos, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so correct. Setting aside Officer Murphy, your complaint reads as if every shot was excessive. But even Judge Waverly in the district court suggested that they had probable cause to fire because the video quite clearly shows the decedent taking a step and acting like he's pointing a gun at them. And so what I'm struggling with is your complaint is blatantly contradicted by the video. But then the district court suggested that we just don't know if some of the officers maybe shot after the threat had gone away. And it's not clear to me that you've alleged this two-step. So it's not obvious to me why your complaint states a claim with respect to anybody other than Officer Murphy, because it says everybody acted excessively, but when I watched the video, at least the initial volley seemed reasonable to me. I agree with the district court.
Your Honor, if I may just point this out, I don't believe that the district court went ahead and excused the initial volley. I believe that the district court said that at this stage, and we're remembering they filed a Rule 12. They did not file a Rule 56. Judge Crenshaw goes over and over inside of his memorandum opinion, and he cites to the Wesley case and says it's inappropriate because there needs to be more factual development. He states, as such, further factual development is necessary to properly consider the individual defendant's qualified immunity claims. When Your Honor brings up...
Why shouldn't you have some type of duty to plead facts that would suggest the other officers plausibly continued to shoot excessively?
I believe any plaintiff in our position would struggle the same way that the district court struggled, which is we have one video. And Your Honor, let's take us back to when we filed our first original complaint, which is over 2 years ago. The only basis that we had to file and craft the complaint was media outlet sources that were released by the defendants. So right out of the gate, we were operating under a position of having videotape evidence that was heavily doctored. It was completely within their control, and they disseminated that to the general public. We then simply could do the best that we possibly could. Judge Crenshaw, in his ruling, in his memorandum opinion, said that one or more of the officers may have continued to shoot him gratuitously after he became incapacitated. So I believe that the district court is having the same problems that we are.
What I'm struggling with is what should be. I have question one, again, setting aside Judge Murphy. I have question one. What are Officer Murphy.
Knew there'd be a thing. Sir.
And I got Judge Crenshaw's name wrong, too. So I'm two for two today. Setting aside Officer Murphy, don't you think you have some pleading obligation to plausibly suggest that maybe one of the other officers also gratuitously shot? And then the question would be, what do we do if we don't know which officer it is? But I'm not certain. Maybe it's unfair to you. Maybe you should be able to amend your complaint with the notion that we think that the complaint as written contradicts the video. But it's not clear to me that you've got the first step of plausibly suggesting that any of the other officers shot kind of whatever you want to call it, gratuitously or after the threat had dissipated.
Correct, Your Honor. I track where you're going. We think about this case because it's a little bit special because we do have a video. In fact, we have a lot of videos of this shooting. We have the one very particularly from Trooper Edge's dash camera, which is the position for which Officer Murphy comes and stands right beside. We have body camera video from Officer Williams, Officer Kidd, Officer Murphy himself. And so all of those videos have been exclusively in their control at the pleading stage. Now, we think about it from the benefit of having the videos, but what would a plaintiff's attorney do if there were not videos? This case would proceed to affidavit stage. It would proceed to a discovery stage. It would proceed to getting to do interrogatories and perhaps some depositions.
Identify that Murphy is shooting after he's down, but there are other shots. We don't know where those are coming from. What do you do with that at the pleading stage when you're not identifying who it is? I'm genuinely asking.
I've been thinking at the same time, and the only explanation is you allow us to proceed to discovery, and we can ask each individual officer, did you perceive a threat after you pulled the first trigger? How many times did you fire? What was going on from your vantage point? They have collapsed this.
I'm struggling with it. It is a quandary. In order to get to discovery, you have to plausibly allege facts that might suggest that one of these officers did that. And the problem I have is, this is why I'm suggesting maybe you could amend, but the problem I have now is you just allege that every shot was excessive. And that just strikes me as blatantly contradicted by the record. So we know we can use the video if it blatantly contradicts the allegation. So the initial allegation that every shot was excessive strikes me as blatantly contradicted by the video. I agree you may have a theory that some of the other officers continued to shoot. But what do you think? Do you think you need to plead some type of circumstantial facts? One fact that I was thinking of was you said there were five shots in the back, which could suggest that he was down, and maybe that's plausible enough. But what can you think of any other facts that would plausibly suggest that are in your complaint that some of the officers?
Yeah, we've been arguing from day one that this is a Fourth Amendment excessive force violation based upon 33 bullets, at least two dozen officers. 12 of those bullets struck our client. The majority of those bullets struck our client in the back.
The response now is not responding, I think, to the point of Murphy, because he's right. The video blatantly contradicts that every shot fired was excessive force. You're probably not surprised that we're saying that, you know, he's gotten in a shooting stance. He looks like he has something in his hand. Those first shots, it would seem a reasonable officer would take the action that we're taking. The issue is, yes, once he was down, shots that came after that, maybe that gets you someplace.
That's correct. I think what we're learning from the district court memorandum is that whenever you jump to step two, which is the excessive force after Mr. Eastep is clearly down and incapacitated, if you collapse the case, and remembering that this is a Rule 12, then that bypasses any of the procedural or protocol errors that would have been committed by Metro Police and the other officers.
What do you think of my hypo of, this might help me, right? So we know that there is one gratuitous shot, and we know that there are potentially 10 officers who shot it. Do you think you could sue all 10 officers and say, allow us to get discovery? We know that you've plausibly pleaded a gratuitous shot. We just don't know which officer. Do you think it depends on the number of officers? I don't know what the rule should be.
We have law students here who have no doubt read Summers versus Tyson in torts class.
I think we start from the very beginning of this. And I think the very beginning is we had a man that was committing no crime, that was not fleeing. He was in no way a danger to anybody. He was walking down the road. And if you read through in the complaint,
that earlier set of factual circumstances doesn't resolve this conundrum. So maybe everything was even messed up beforehand, and maybe things weren't via protocol or things like that, but we still have a question about who shot.
There's multiple segments. And we
so we can, who cares about the multiple segments? I'm giving you the key fact for you, which is there was a gratuitous shot.
Yes, sir.
And we just don't know who it was. And I'm just curious on what we think the legal principles should be at the pleading stage. I mean, is plausibility percentage, if we think it's 3, then that's enough. If it's 10, that's too many. That doesn't strike me.
Can it be plausible to everyone who drew a gun and shot at all, shot right? Whereas maybe it's not plausible to people who didn't even have a gun drawn and didn't shoot, or like, how do we assess plausibility?
Number one, we never named any police officer who did not fire a weapon that day. Okay. And there could have been multiple folks that were also liable for this that could have taken on a supervisory role. We did not do that. We started backwards from the position of Officer Murphy clearly exercised excessive force. He should have used restraint and he did not. We then worked our way backwards. And we started thinking about this from a perspective of, is 33 shots at somebody that we know is unarmed? I'm with the bench because I have thought about this as well. What should an officer have done in that split second decision? Our client made a mistake. Our client made a gesture, and we're owning that. He made a gesture that he should not have. But to go ahead and say that everything that leads up to that man making that one mistake bypasses and excuses the enormity of mistakes that were made during the preceding 40 minutes of this standoff. Because when you have more officers, when you have more showing of force, there were police helicopters flying. When you have an incredibly public daylight scenario, like on the side of Interstate 65, we're arguing that those first shots should never have occurred. Landon Eastet made one critical mistake. And that was, he made the gesture. But those
established supports what you just said, taken.
Your Honor, I think that to make that determination at this stage, at the Rule 12 stage, is premature. We would like to go in and figure out what did these individual officers perceive. We could see clearly from the video they are yelling cease fire. One officer even uses a profanity. He says, GD, afterwards, he's expressing his displeasure. Officer Williams, you can see, is visibly shaken. He's crying. He's going over to the guardrail. He's kicking the guardrail. Officer Murphy goes up to him and tries to cheer him up. We know that there are officers who, if we were to put them to deposition, I have a feeling that they're not going to toe the thin blue line. I think that they're going to say, we could have avoided this. When we start talking about how easily it would have been to use less lethal forces, we put that inside of our brief. You can clearly see through some of our photographs that we captured in our brief that the officers were equipped with less lethal means, and they never even attempted to use those. A bear spray, a mace, a rubber bullet, our expert, which we have hired, indicates that this is one of the most disastrous cases for police misconduct leading up to the shots. Now, they have filed a Rule 12. We argue that the Rule 12 should be denied. We argue that this case should go forward, but we're asking the court not to do what was done in the Hood decision. Hood decision, they said, yep, excessive force, too many shots at the end, but the initial encounter was justified. We're saying, were this a Rule 56? Were you being presented with contradictory affidavits, some from us, some from them? Perhaps officers who have testified indicate that, no, we knew we didn't need to shoot this guy. These officers on the side of the road had no idea why Mr. Eastep was being surrounded. Had no idea.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can start maybe if you have any thoughts on the hypos we just talked about, because that's the thing that I'm probably most interested in, which is this pleading standard for when you have potential gratuitous force, but you don't know the officer who engaged in it.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case that would sort of directly addresses that. But when you look back at Iqbal, Iqbal is all about a specific claim against the specific individuals. So there, the plaintiff had alleged all manner of problems with his confinement, and that there was that there was a policy for the FBI to clear high interest individuals. But his claim was that they racially discriminated against me. Well, one didn't follow from the other. And the court said, you have to tell us what these defendants did wrong. And you have to state a plausible claim against these defendants. Here, we don't have a plausible claim. We have speculation. And what
can you actually answer Judge Murphy's hypo? Right? If there is a clearly gratuitous shot 30 seconds after someone is clearly down, clearly immobilized, clearly not threatening deadly force against anyone, and there are three officers there, maybe they all have their guns drawn, but there's one bullet. We don't know who shot it. Are you saying that there's no plausibility and the case gets dismissed against all three of them at the 12B stage?
I think that the answer is yes, Your Honor, and I don't have a case site for me.
How would the plaintiff have the information about who shot?
So I also want to point out that that hypothetical is not the case here.
Right, but that hypothetical that Judge Murphy has asked gets to the underlying idea of how do we deal with these situations where there are, you know, perhaps gratuitous shots and we don't know who they're from because a lot of officers have fired their weapons.
Correct, Your Honor. And I recognize the quandary that could put plaintiffs in. But turning to the facts of our case, Judge Murphy's case, I made the same mistake. Here, the video does blatantly contradict what the plaintiff said happened. And so those first shots are constitutional. During plaintiff's entire argument, he didn't cite a single case that would find that the officers couldn't reasonably perceive that Mr. Estep posed a threat. And he speculated about what these officers knew and what their subjective intent was. The Fourth Amendment inquiry is a reasonable one, so not a subjective one. What will change between the motion to dismiss stage and summary judgment, since we have the video, is not much. We would ask that this court reverse the district court, grant qualified immunity, and dismiss the case. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I would also direct Your Honor to the plaintiff's complaint where it quotes extensively from the TBI report, which is about an 800-page report, and that's where they get the information about who fired how many bullets or who fired how many shots. So I think that the plaintiffs could have pled that information if they wanted to, and the fact that they didn't is telling. Thank you.
Thank you both. The case will be submitted and can call the next case.